From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on July 6th, when Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg told the Associated Press that she didn't even want to think about the prospect of a Donald Trump presidency. To say the least, it was unusual for a justice to wade into an election season. If she was having any hesitation about criticizing an active candidate for office, she didn't show it then, because next, she told the New York Times that a Trump presidency was the kind of thing that would have convinced her late husband to say they should move to New Zealand. That sparked some debate about whether Ginsburg or any sitting justice should be weighing in on politics, and a few days later she told CNN that Donald Trump is, quote, a faker who makes things up as he goes along, end quote. Now, by that point, political leaders and legal analysts on all sides were criticizing Ginsburg for stepping out of the traditional judicial code of conduct. And sure, Trump himself said she should resign and that her mind was shot, but plenty of progressives said that Ginsburg was flat-out wrong, and plenty of legal analysts. Slate's Dahlia Lithwick called the remarks improper. The New York Times editorial board wrote, quote, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg needs to drop the political punditry and the name-calling, end quote. And the Washington Post editorial board wrote, quote, Justice Ginsburg's off-the-cuff remarks about the campaign fall into that limited category of candor that we can't admire because it's inconsistent with her function in our democratic system, end quote. Ginsburg's defenders have argued that she was making a calculated decision to speak about a historically dangerous political figure. Others have argued that we should stop pretending judges aren't political themselves. So this hour, we welcome a panel with varying experience in the law to discuss the question of whether it's ever proper for a judge to speak out about political candidates. Let me welcome my guests. In studio is Mark Foti. He's a local criminal defense attorney and chair of the Monroe County Bar Association Criminal Justice Section. Mark, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Jim Bowers is here. He's a professor of political science and legal studies at St. John Fisher College. Jim, welcome.
Glad to be back, Evan.
And on the line with us is Judge Patricia Marks, a retired Monroe County court judge who spent 25 years on the bench. Judge Marks, always great to have you. Thanks for being here.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Let me start with you, Judge Marks. Just your first take on when you first heard the remarks from Justice Bader Ginsburg, what did you think?
I was disappointed. I admire her a great deal, and I felt perhaps I don't think there was anything per se unethical because of the different codes that apply to Supreme Court justices, but I think it was disappointing. She should have shown more restraint.
Okay, Mark Foti, what did you think when you heard him?
Well, I think the first impression was one of shock, just because it's something that we haven't seen in quite some time. I agree that in terms of an ethical analysis, there's different rules that apply to Supreme Court justices, so I think I reserved on forming an opinion immediately as to whether there was an appropriateness of this. But on the other hand, it certainly was something that was unusual, and it was easy to recognize that almost immediately.
Okay. Jim Bowers, what did you think?
I'm apparently the contrary voice.
Okay.
The only thing that Justice Ginsburg did was basically reveal what any of us who studied judicial behavior knows. Judges are political actors. The justices on the Supreme Court are selected for political reasons. What she simply did was, tear down the veil that was over propping up the myth. So I have no real objections to what she did because there is so much in law, there's so much in constitutional interpretation that is a myth. And we push the myth because we really can't accept the legal realism that dominates the courtroom, that dominates constitutional interpretation.
All right, let's listen to what Justice Ginsburg told NPR about her remarks. She has since apologized, and this is part of that conversation with NPR.
I said something I should not have said. And I made a statement that reads, on reflection, my recent remarks in response to press inquiries were ill-advised. I regret making them. Judges should avoid commenting on a candidate for public office. In the future, I will be more circumspect. And that's exactly how I feel about this whole business.
All right, so Jim Bowers, Justice Ginsburg herself is disagreeing with you.
Well, I don't think she is in this regard. sat over a glass of wine with colleagues. Her problem was she said in a live microphone. We forget, Sandra Day O'Connor used to work the cocktail circuit in D.C., and she'd be out talking about, oh, I have no intentions of retiring unless there's a Republican president. I mean, that's, you know, it may not sound as shocking, but, you know, it's a recognition that these people look at what party they serve. They look at what ideology they serve. They look at what interpretation of the Constitution they serve. And frankly, none of which may actually have anything to do with the actual correct meaning of the Constitution. And that is justices on the left and the right and the middle. So, you know, circumspect, I take as saying, fine, say it over a glass of wine at a cocktail party, but don't say it around a live microphone.
But that's part of the point, Jim. I mean, this, and Judge Marks, I know you disagree with Jim on this, so why don't you go ahead there?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of thoughts I have about this, but when a judge speaks publicly about something, it carries a lot of weight. But there's also something to be said for the fact, back when Sandra Day O'Connor commented on how Al Gore would be terrible for the country, she did so publicly, and she participated in Bush versus Gore decision.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Anyway, so to some extent, I don't totally disagree with Jim, but I see a greater ideal for judges because the impact of what judges say and how they reflect on the quality of justice and the process for the public to better understand. The press is covering this more widely than they covered Sandra Day O'Connor's comments, which is always fascinating to me. But it does impact the public's impression, and that appearance, I think, is important for quality of justice.
And on that subject, Judge Marks, I want to ask you this point, because nobody, I can't think of a single person who, if you would have asked 3 weeks ago, do you think Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a fan of Donald Trump? Nobody would have thought that she is. Everyone would have said yes. She would say that he would be an awful president. They wouldn't be surprised to hear her say exactly what she told CNN and the AP and the New York Times. So can you articulate for the audience that may be confused? So what's the big deal that she said it publicly? Everyone knew she probably thought it. Judge Marks, what's the difference?
The difference is she has confirmed it. And she has said it in her position as a judge. And judges have to show restraint and be circumspect, as she actually said. And I think the weight of it and what judges say is something that's very hard for the public to understand. But I recall, as a judge for 25 years, there's lots of things I wanted to say that I knew I could not say because it would carry greater weight than if someone who was not a judge said it. The weight it carries saying it publicly is part of this impact.
Well, Mark Foti, as someone who is a criminal defense attorney, what is your expectation for judges and why you think that they should not be making these kind of comments, even if it's obvious that they probably feel that way?
Well, I agree with pretty much everybody that we can all sort of come to a conclusion as to which way Justice Ginsburg would have been leaning on the election even without having heard the comments. And I think we could do that for pretty much everybody who sits on the Supreme Court right now, as well as most judges in any capacity that they're currently serving. Most of them have political backgrounds. There's no question about that. Most of them were either elected to the position or appointed by somebody who was elected to a position. But the issue that was interesting was that there was an interview initially where she made her comments. When she talked to the New York Times, she made her comments. And I think that had she simply stated the opinion and then sort of backed off of any further comment, nobody would have necessarily questioned it as or to the degree that they have at this point. I think when she decided to continue to comment in different media outlets, there were headlines suggesting that she was doubling down on the comments, I think I read at some point. And part of it brought about the question of at what point are you simply stating an opinion and what point are you stepping beyond that and beginning to advocate? And if you're advocating as part of the political process, then it's more than simply having a background and an opinion and a tendency to lean in a particular direction politically. Now you've taken a position where you are pushing for a particular result, and that's when rendering a decision could potentially be compromised. I think that's the concern that certain people have, even a lot of people who lean on the left side of things who would tend to agree with the comments she made themselves, but had concerns with the comments being made, especially multiple times.
Professor Jim Bowers?
Well, first off, I want to go back. I actually agree with Judge Marks on the notion of a higher ideal. But what I want to get across is that Ginsburg revealed the reality. And, you know, I'm of two minds. I really do embrace legal realism, including some of the work of Jerome Frank, which was largely psychological, because we know that we've seen empirical studies that show anything, and I know we're talking about public comments, but still, that judges at all level engage in implicit bias. We can see it from sentencing, the racial aspect of sentencing. We can see it in a variety of things. We see it. We see other aspects with the justices in my own discipline. When you look at some of the strategic calculations that the justices make as to whether they want to hear a case or not, the bargaining that takes place over the opinions, the reason people are upset about this, I think, isn't what she said as much as what she did was erode the illusion of neutrality by judges. And law, frankly, only works, and this is one reason I do agree with Judge Marks, when we are able to maintain the myth of neutrality. But particularly when it comes to constitutional interpretation, study after study after study can show that the outcome drives the interpretation, not that the interpretation drives the outcome. So what you have is a body that we call constitutional law, which is not the Constitution. I had a professor years ago, and it took me a few years to appreciate what he meant when he says, Jim, always remember there is a difference between what the Constitution means and what constitutional law is. And I think that Justice Ginsburg, with these overt political comments, have basically indicated that judging is not neutral.
Okay, I want to ask Judge Marks if you either appreciate or have some concern about Jim's use of the phrase, the myth of neutrality. I mean, you served on the bench for 25 years. Is it a myth?
Well, I hope in my case it was not a myth. It was a strong exercise that when there were any biases, I removed myself from the case. It's a different type of mindset. And when you speak publicly on something, it changes your ability to reach that level of neutrality and lack of bias. And you do have to examine, if you're being honest with yourself, you have to examine what that bias is, how you eliminate it, how you look at the counterpoint, and really get the information you need to make a neutral decision. If you're outspoken in your view, you ruin that ability, that exercise that you engage in as a judge, or I engaged in as a judge, that says, wait a second, you need more information to make a good decision and be unbiased about it. Look at what the law is. It isn't what your personal opinion is. It isn't your cocktail party comment. It's what the law says it should be, and it's what a fair decision should be based on having good information and discerning and doing the research and work you need to do. That changes how you make the decision as opposed to an off-cuff remark when someone asks you about your personal opinion of something.
And Judge, a couple of points. I know Jim wants to follow up here, and listeners, if you want to join the conversation with comments or questions on these matters, we invite your phone calls. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Judge Marks, let me just work backwards a little bit here. First, when it comes to Sandra Day O'Connor, you mentioned her comments about Al Gore and the fact that she still participated in the Bush-Gore decision. Should she have had to recuse herself for that decision?
I think that's a great question. I'm not sure. If she felt in her mind she could separate her comments, settle down, focus on the issue, this is different from her personal opinion of Gore and her knowledge of what the election laws are. Is it going to color it? Is she having an honest conversation with herself that she can pull herself out of that personal comment and that personal state of mind and consider the law as it applies? when you consider the uniqueness of that particular opinion, I don't see how she ultimately concluded that it would not bias her opinion, mm-hmm. because there wasn't a clear precedent for her to follow, so that I would think that expression of personal opinion would have influenced. It also would influence how that decision was perceived by others who heard her say it, which is why the public nature of the comment makes it different.
And I think what I'm trying to work through, Judge, is for the listeners who kind of come into this conversation thinking, well, so what? Of course Ginsburg doesn't like Trump. What? How does this impact anything? All she's saying is publicly is what she would obviously say privately. I think what I'm taking of this so far is that if you look at Sandra Day O'Connor's comments about Gore and then her participation in Bush-Gore, and now you look at Ginsburg's comments about Trump and the question of whether she would have to recuse if a Trump presidency and if his administration ever came before the Supreme Court, would she be compromised because of her public comments? First of all, when you make public comments, it may erode public trust that you could set aside potential biases and interpret the law. Is that fair? At the very least, can you understand why people look at Sandra Day O'Connor and say, how in the world was she part of that?
I agree. I think that was well articulated.
Okay.
That. Thank you.
And so are you concerned, Judge, then, that Ginsburg, if she stays on the bench, and she may, I mean, I think she's 84, she may decide she wants to serve even if Donald Trump is president, or especially if Donald Trump is president, but would she be in jeopardy now of having to recuse herself if his administration comes before the court?
I think she would be in jeopardy. I don't know what the final conclusion could be until I gave it more thought.
Okay, and I will also ask our panelists in studio with this. I know Judge Marks' time is a little limited today, so
right.
Let me ask you one more quick question then, Judge.
Sure.
When you first became a judge, I mean, most of us, me included, will never serve on a bench. And we talk about codes of conduct. We talk about the way judges are supposed to behave, et cetera. I'm curious to know, what was articulated to you? What were the conversations? What was your understanding of the role? How does that process work when you become a judge?
It's difficult, particularly in the context of an election. I had an election. I served as a nominated candidate for a particular party. So you really needed that time to separate yourself. We engaged in training. We had ethics training as well to review what the code of conduct is. And then there's sort of a personal separation from your advocacy role. It's a complex process. It was always helpful to share it with other new judges and draw on the experience of experienced judges. But it is difficult because, as Jim alluded to, it's political, particularly when you run for election. A lot of people did things to help you get elected and might have expectations, and you had to be careful and make sure you recused yourself in the context of cases where people had helped you so that no one would perceive there is an expectation of favoritism. But it's a struggle to not give personal opinions. I mean, lawyers who are advocates always have personal opinions, so it really is a change in the way you think, a change in the way you conduct yourself to be sure that the system is right and that you work toward unbiased. And it's constant. It's not just the transition from election to taking the oath and sitting on the bench. It's constant because you're constantly exposed to information, and you have to be sure your information gathering process is unbiased and complete.
All right. Before we let Judge Marks go, at the half-hour mark here, our listeners are weighing in, trying to point to, I think they're pointing to a number of instances in which it seemed that Supreme Court justices were also behaving politically. And let me grab a phone call. Tom in Greece wants to weigh in on that point. Go ahead,
Tom. Yes, hello.
Yes.
Thank you. I recall the only time I remember in public that I saw that where a Supreme Court justice did not behave in a way that justices are expected to act, I mean, politically impartial, was during President Obama's 2010 State of the Union message, when he came to the part where he was attacking the Citizens United decision, and Justice Samuel Alito frowned at him and shook his head in disagreement.
He mouthed the words, not true.
What?
the justice sitting there mouthed the words "not true" at that moment.
Yes. Yeah, not well. Okay, yes. Oh, not true was that. Oh, okay, well, I mean, that's the only time I saw that. Now, I don't know if a president has ever, in any State of the Union message, ever attacked a specific decision by the Supreme Court before. I don't know if that's ever happened, but I was wondering, has Justice Alito ever apologized or said that perhaps his behavior at that time was out of line with what is expected of Supreme Court justices or anything? And I just want to know what your guests think of that. I'll take my answer off the air.
Tom, thanks for the phone call. Maybe Megan Mack, producer, can help me do a little research and find out if Justice Alito has ever commented on that. I don't know offhand, but before I kick it to Judge Marks and the rest of our panel, here's writer and consultant and Democratic activist Jay Levine, who is weighing in on the Ginsburg issue. He says, quote, "I await Justice Alito's apology for interrupting the State of the Union with not true, and Justice Thomas's apology for having his wife collect huge consulting fees from conservative activists seeking decisions before the Supreme Court. And while we're at it, I'd like an apology for Justice Scalia's chummy hunting trips with the sitting vice president at the time," end quote. That's sort of a continuation on Tom's question. Judge Marks, are those legitimate complaints about the behaviors of those justices?
I think they're legitimate comments. I think I like that this dialogue is occurring and people are looking at the role of judges and the importance of objectivity. And judges are human. They might make mistakes. And if they recognize that mistake, I think that's part of the strength of Judge Ginsburg, acknowledging that she was a little bit injudicious in making the comments. Perhaps not unethical, but injudicious. She acknowledged it and apologized. I think that's huge, and it makes us have a conversation about what makes a fair judge.
All right. Before I get to our panelists in studio, Judge Marks, I'm going to let you go because I know how busy your schedule is. And I just want to say, since your quote-unquote retirement, I know you've remained active in many ways. And I also know you've made a lot of time for this program. And your perspective is always very helpful. It's not obviously, you know, we can't interview sitting judges in most times. So it's great to have you and your perspective. And I hope to talk to you again soon.
I'll look forward to it. Thank you very much.
That's Judge Patricia Marks joining the program. Okay, Mark Foti, on the subjects of those other complaints, Alito in 2010 mouthing not true when Obama is talking about Citizens United, Scalia on a hunting trip with Dick Cheney. Was that when he shot somebody in the face, by the way?
Yeah,
I think
so.
That was. maybe that was the universe telling him, but I don't know. Other cases, Justice Thomas, his wife and her activities, are those equal in any way to Ginsburg's comments? Are they concerning to you in any way, in the having worked in the legal system?
Well, I think each one of those examples is concerning in its own independent way. I mean, each one is distinguishable from the next. There's different examples being given here, and each of them have some significance as to why that may be inappropriate. There is a long history in the Supreme Court and the involvement that the Supreme Court justices have had with individual executive administrations, and that's evolved over time, probably to a place where there's more self-policing, and maybe to some example, in some cases, it's more appropriate, or at least attempts to be more appropriate than it has been in the past. But each one of those examples raises legitimate concerns. I don't think that the effort to cite these examples necessarily ends the discussion or diverts a discussion about another individual example, specifically in this case what Justice Ginsburg said and whether that's appropriate or not. I think that discussion still needs to happen.
But I agree.
But I think each of those examples, there was some discussion at the time, and I think there's still ongoing discussion because there's no hardline rule of ethics that applies to the Supreme Court justices. So this is a much murkier conversation each time it comes up.
Okay. Professor Bowers?
Well, yeah, I would agree with Mark. I mean, you've got there's we could do both hours on this easily. Because if you go back even to Judge Marks, who I agree with in this regard, she's focusing quite a bit on an overt bias that the judge is aware of, okay? And yes, those are easier to control and probably doesn't require someone to recuse themselves. Mark's comments about the other activities of justices, yeah, we can go way back. You know, Harlan Stone was a confidant of Herbert Hoover's. You go black on the Supreme Court because he led the court packing plan, and it was basically an obscene gesture, you might say, on the part of Roosevelt to the court when he appointed Hugo Black. You can look at Abe Fortas and the close relationship with Lyndon Johnson. You can look at Earl Warren, who was a wartime governor of California, embraced the internment of the Japanese, and was Dewey's vice presidential candidate in 48, as I don't recall, I'm not that old, but as I recall history. So I think part of the issue is the distinction between overt comments like Justice Ginsburg made versus, we might even call them, covert relationships that judges have. But again, asking whether the comments were appropriate or not, I actually think is the wrong question. That's why I keep going back to, what does her comments reveal about the nature of judging in the first place? See, to me, that's a more fundamental question. And Judge Marks, I thought when she made that comment about, well, you know, judges are humans. Jerome Frank, one of his leading chapters in one of his textbooks, was that specific comment, judges are human. That, why do you expect a judge to set aside their attitudes, set aside their personal values, their personal beliefs, the things that influence them, the political attitudes they have, simply because they put on a black robe? None of us could do it. Why do we expect a judge? Why do we expect that transformation? Now, Frank was focusing more on the behavior of judges, particularly on trial courts, but we could say the same thing about Supreme Court justices. You can see that they're already political players because you can look at the patterns of their votes.
I think, of course, they're political players, Jim. I think what I'm seeing here, and maybe there is some artifice to this idea that the ideal is impossible. You know, there is no notion of perfection in which a justice gets appointed because of a record by someone who is a political actor. I mean, we've got a whole Supreme Court seat unfilled right now because of this very issue.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there is some ridiculousness to this idea that they're apolitical. But I don't think the idea is that they have to be apolitical. I think the idea is when they start speaking about political candidates, and they look like they are sort of trying to influence elections, weigh in on elections, and you may argue, but of course, we shouldn't be surprised that's how they feel. Doesn't the job require them? You know, if you want to talk about politics, don't sit on the bench. You know, that's part of the job, isn't it?
I'm not convinced that it is. We believe that it is. And I think, again, not trying to turn this also into a deeply philosophical discussion.
No, I'm enjoying this because I
want to be sensitive to what you invite us on to talk to, and I hope you find this still relevant.
I find this exactly
good.
The point.
Good. Because I would go back and say, again, why do we believe that's an important ingredient? It goes back. And this is why I call it the myth of neutrality, okay? We're only uncomfortable when that myth is challenged, when the curtain of neutrality comes up and we actually see judges are human, we go, oh my God, she shouldn't have said that. Well, she was thinking it anyway. The only reason to keep her silent is to make us comfortable.
To give us the illusion of neutrality.
There you go.
Okay, now I understand the point, but I think you might be attacking a straw man. So let me work through this and invite Mark to join my fusillade against Jimmy. but let me just say this. When you say the myth of neutrality, I don't think Mark Foti is saying he wants judges to be neutral as people. I don't think I feel that way. I think what I expect is that they recognize to the best degree of their ability, they are self-aware of biases. Just as I try to be self-aware of my biases as a talk show host and make sure it's not only one person or one side of an argument, et cetera, gets invited. And when you are self-aware, you do your best to interpret the law as you see it, occasionally ruling in a way that says, Well, I wish it didn't go this way, but I have to agree that this is what the law says. And okay. Judge Marks is indicating to us that part of her career, there those moments happen.
Okay, I want because you already warned me. But
you're a filibusterer, Bowers. But
no,
go ahead.
I just want to make a little. I want to. What is it we used to do in Amazon and all that bookmark?
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Just want to bookmark what you said about interpretation, so we can come back to it. So,
okay,
that's all I want to say.
Mark
Foti. Sorry, Mark.
No, it's no problem. The one thing I would note that I think is relevant to this particular part of the discussion is that Justice Ginsburg, her comments related to Trump were the comments that have been signaled out and covered with the most scrutiny. But there was other comments she made during the course of the interview that definitely had a political influence. She discussed the fact that she wants the Senate to fill the role, that's really their job, and that's what her comments related to on that particular topic. She discussed certain cases that had passed recently and the significance of the decisions, and the decisions that she focused on as being her favorite cases, or the results had been decisions that she favored, were ones that had some socially liberal element to it. So the comments in general throughout the interview did have a political slant. But the problem that the majority of the people, including the New York Times and the subsequent editorial, had with her comments overall were those that related to that focused in on a political candidate. It wasn't so much they had a problem with the comments being liberal slanted or leaning in a particular direction. I think that's expected. And I think generally the public not only anticipates that, they look for comments consistent with that from the justices that have always voted in a particular manner. But what was unexpected was when she delved into the political election and having such a strong opinion about the candidate, and then continued to do so in the subsequent interviews. I don't think that the public necessarily expects there to be an illusion, or there to be maintained an illusion of neutrality. In fact, I think because our judges are often selected by election and many people make their decision based on party lines, I think they expect their political background to have some influence in the way they preside over cases. But with that said, we had an unusual circumstance where you had a Supreme Court justice weighing in specifically on an upcoming election, as opposed to a particular decision or a disagreement with the way administration may have rendered a particular decision along the way. And I think that's what people have found to be problematic. Even people on both sides of the aisle who may have tended to agree with her comments, and in this particular election, people there's even Republicans who agreed with her comments, who obviously still took issue with the idea that the Supreme Court justice would be openly expressing them in the course of an election.
All right, I'm going to give you 1 minute to respond to that, because I saw you twitching at several points. But then I've got to get the only break in. And some of our listeners think, right. So, should we get that break
you
now?
I can twitch.
All right, let's do this. Let's get the only break of the hour. Our listeners think we're missing 2 points here. And we're going to get to those right when we come back as we talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's comments. I think Jim is about to dive into the very nature
twitching.
Of free will.
Twitching.
Yeah, well.
You're watching me way too close.
Well, I was watching you listen to Mark there. Mark is a local criminal defense attorney and chair of the Monroe County Bar Association Criminal Justice Section. And Jim Bowers is a professor of political science and legal studies at St. John Fisher College. We'll get your phone calls, and we're going to weigh in on what the listeners think we are missing in this discussion next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, why so much hate? Why so much vitriol about the new Ghostbusters film? Why were there so many negative reviews of the film before it even came out? Do I even have to ask and try to answer that question? Is it too obvious? Well, we'll talk about gender issues at play, we'll talk about race, and we'll talk about the film. Was it any good on the merits? Ghostbusters 2016, that's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Paul Narondequoit, hang there, because I know you want to jump in too. But I said that there were things that the listeners thought we were missing. Here's the big one that a lot of listeners are writing about. They're essentially saying that we are analyzing Justice Ginsburg's remarks about Donald Trump under the guise of whether it's proper. And most of the agreement, I think most have said not proper, or at least out of the code of conduct. What I'm hearing is this is a unique situation. that she weighed her options, she surveyed the landscape and said, I've got to step out of line because I am concerned that this is a unique threat. And there are people who have written about this, and let me read. Erwin Kamerinsky is the dean of the UC Irvine School of Law. Here's an op-ed that Erwin wrote for the LA Times. Quote, Ginsburg knows that too often bad things happen because, as the saying goes, good people do nothing. She knew she had a platform, and she used it. And Glenn Greenwald, who is an attorney and a longtime media critic, he's a strong progressive and the founder of The Intercept, he wrote, quote, is the pretense of neutrality really so sacrosanct for judges and journalists, etc., that no threat or injustice can warrant its abandonment? In other words, what Greenwald is saying is Donald Trump presents something uniquely threatening to this republic, and Ginsburg, in this case, probably realized, I'm not supposed to talk about political candidates, but this is different. I'm going to do it. Because we can't sit around here and do nothing. Mark Foti, what do you make of that line of the argument?
I tend to disagree that even though Donald Trump does have the hallmarks of a unique candidate for several reasons, that somehow carves out an exception for what would otherwise be appropriate or inappropriate. I think every election cycle, there's going to be people who have such strong feelings about candidates on the other side of the political spectrum that they could make the argument that there's aspects of that candidate that makes them so uniquely dangerous to the public that they have to somehow step in.
We hear that every election cycle, really.
Right.
Most important election of our lifetimes,
right. You know,
most important choice, future of the country at stake.
I think it's a dangerous precedent to use that as a basis for why this would be appropriate, because then every election cycle you're going to have certain candidates step out, speak their opinions on the way the public should consider the candidates, and then they're going to justify it with that very argument that, well, this is a unique situation, this election is extremely important, the significance exists for the following reasons, and that's why I felt compelled to do a service to the public by expressing my opinion, which has some value here.
Okay. Jim Bowers, what do you make of that line of the argument?
Well, actually, I'm more inclined to agree with the comments of the last person you read, because I think your listeners are correct in this regard. And this is maybe also why it doesn't bother me. Justice Ginsburg basically chose her role as citizen over her role as judge. And in that regard, judges and justices retain their rights. They retain their freedom of speech. They retain the ability to choose which part of their life they're putting greater emphasis on. Now, would she have been listened to if she was just Ruth Ginsburg? No. So being a justice helped her with the platform. But I can see the argument. And frankly, to sneak in a little convention discussion, we ought to be concerned about Donald Trump because he's the closest thing we've had to an American fascist in years. Gee, I've just revealed myself, haven't I? In that regard, I don't necessarily like the strident way Elizabeth Warren might characterize him. She's not that far off. But I'm just saying. So I think for her to stand there and warn us is quite appropriate as a citizen.
All right, so I take the point there. And now let me get Paul and Aranda Coit. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, this whole Ginsburg thing is, here's how I look at it. Let's just say, hypothetically, the woman was totally wrong in what she did. Well, then you got to ask yourself, why did she do it? I think sooner or later, due to the lifetime appointments, we're going to find people that really their judgment is impaired due to their age. And what will happen when that occurs? Now, my own opinion is we have to come up with some sort of plan. And, you know, to me, it was just totally inappropriate what she did. And there is a difference. If you're a priest, if you're a policeman, if you're a judge, there is a difference in what you say and what you do in the public eye. And that's just the way it is. And it's the way it should be.
All right,
and
Paul,
it's my comment.
Paul, thanks very much for calling. Mark Foti, you're an attorney. Do you have a problem with lifetime appointments for the reasons that Paul lays out?
I think Paul actually raises some good points that have obviously been considered in the past. And the public has generally trusted that a justice or a judge would step aside when they're no longer able to function. But there's a number of issues with the judicial system, and lifetime appointments is certainly one that is heavily analyzed as being potentially problematic, and in some cases it has been problematic. I think the flip side to that is the reason people support lifetime appointments is because when there's no election or additional confirmation down the road, they expect that the person will be, the judge will be less biased going forward, that they won't have the pressures of deciding matters in a way that will placate a certain group that may have some influence over whether they can continue to serve in the position. So I think there's an argument for why there's value for it, along with the argument for why there is a legitimate concern that somebody may overstay their welcome, for lack of a better term. One thing I'd like to note is that it's come up over a number of time over the years, and I think it came up as recently as last year, that there was discussion of putting in place rules and guidelines for the way the Supreme Court justices would behave. A lot of these discussions are so broad because those don't exist for the Supreme Court justices. They're sort of carved out of the rules and the code of judicial conduct that applies to many other judges and what they're allowed to comment on. And I think that was, I think it was the Supreme Court Ethics Act was what was put forth last year, was sponsored by a number of Democrats, and I think even Louise Slaughter spoke to it and advocated for it, with the idea that putting some rules in place would help define when something is said or done, whether it's going outside the bounds of what's appropriate for them. But it has never moved forward because, in part, I think generally the public trusts that the Supreme Court bench will act appropriately and conduct themselves as the public expects them to.
Regarding the politicization of the court, as some see it, I can't recommend enough. There's a new podcast. Radiolab has spun off a podcast called More Perfect about the Supreme Court. It tells fascinating stories in the context of how the court has interpreted them. Go back to what Felix Frankfurter said decades ago. That episode was amazing. Go listen to More Perfect. Put it in your podcast queue. That's very good. Professor Bowers, time to end lifetime appointments?
No. Okay. I have quite a bit of confidence in what the framers intended. And I think the idea of an independent and even insulated federal judiciary is important. However, and I'm trying to call up my amendments here, Mark, so help me. Though there may make sense to have, and I think this is what you're alluding to, some kind of amendment that would address the disability of a justice, much the way that we address, I think it's in the 22nd Amendment, the disability of a president. So you don't have, and I hope this is an offensive word, let's say a feeble-minded or whatever the appropriate word would be here, a dysfunctioning justice presiding over
impacted
cases.
By illness, yeah, impacted yeah. by dementia,
right? And there
incapacitated
should,
in some
and I would agree that there should be some process. And similar to how we would address a president that was not now fit to serve office, but who could recover, or we find a way to appropriately remove them short of impeachment.
Okay, Mark?
I think what can alleviate these concerns to some degree is that even though the judiciary is not an executive branch or legislative branch, there does tend to be, in most jurisdictions, really in all jurisdictions, there is some administrative capacity to the assignment of cases and to how a judge is engaging in their particular job and how many cases they're currently taking and what type of cases they're hearing. So I think that there's some oversight that is not really reviewed in the public. It's more it's somewhat behind closed doors, and that's not to give the appearance of impropriety. It's simply a necessity that there is somebody appropriately delegating cases in the direction they're supposed to go. So I do think that although there's no constitutional amendment, I think that there are certain safeguards that allow for cases to go appropriately to the judges that will preside over them and be capable of doing so appropriately.
All right, let me get Sam in Rochester next. Go ahead, Sam.
I wanted to say that, Donald Trump had Jeff Sessions last night as one of his main speakers. And Jeff Sessions, while he was in Alabama, he made a comment that said one of his counterparts who was white should be ashamed of himself, and that he was a disgrace to his white race for representing a black man. Now, do you think that he should have been on that podium last night making a statement like that about another American in the United States? And this is what Jared Ginsburg was talking about. We have to be careful who we throw our support behind and who we solidify as being the leader of the free world. And people are not looking at the people that he has around him. Look at Chris Christie. He's got to go to court for the bridge gate thing. And we all know that Chris Christie did that. He did it out of hate, did it out of vengeance, because Chris Christie couldn't have his way. And yet he says Hillary Clinton ought to be in an orange suit. No, he should be in an orange suit, because if we remember, someone died on that bridge gate.
Sam, let me just jump in and say, you know, you're pointing to Jeff Sessions. You could point to a lot in the last 2 days at that convention and wonder who was on the stage and why, including a soap star claiming that Obama is a Middle Eastern Muslim who has the stage at the RNC. But I take the point, Sam. I don't want to veer too far off in that course. What Sam is simply saying is he's agreeing with those who say this is a unique concern, and he understands Ginsburg's concerns. I want to read a comment from a listener on Twitter, and I think that will feed into what Professor Bowers wanted to talk about when it comes to interpretation. So on Twitter, Steve writes, "Judge neutrality ends at the start of their career when their name is on a party line on a ballot. If they're neutral, why are they running on a party line?"
Okay. I'm going to tweak that just a little bit.
Go ahead.
Since the bulk of what we're talking about is Supreme Court justices. I would agree
but
with that.
But not just Supreme Court, but go ahead.
Okay, but I agree with that. But to keep it in this context, I would also add this. The neutrality of a judge stops the day he or she enters into law school for this reason.
And I am not indicting your profession. I'm very fond of lawyers.
Okay,
but you wouldn't be the first one.
Yeah, no, but I have kind of, here's what I mean. If nothing else, law school, despite this notion of learning to think like a lawyer, all actually reinforces the lack of neutrality in this regard. Those who ultimately become judges are first trained to be advocates. That's what law is. That means you take a side. Now, the textbook lawyer is somebody who can argue either sides, but we know, you know, lawyers drift to practice areas. They drift to a point of view of law. Judges can't remove themselves when it comes to interpreting law from that role of advocacy that they've always played in. And you particularly see this in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court justices, their pet and favorite interpretations of the Constitution and its key provisions become their clients. It's like their clients. There's a reason why Bill Brennan could never embrace capital punishment despite the Constitution saying it's okay. There's a reason why Justice Thomas will never move on certain things, why Ginsburg and all of these people won't move on certain things, because their interpretation is a mix of ideology, politics, and it's also their clients.
And even accepting this framing, what possible paradigm exists to ever have a quote-unquote neutral judge, Jim?
I actually have the answer to that.
Oh, gosh. Okay. I thought you were going to say good point, but go ahead. I'm on my last minute, so you got to be
Well,
quick.
That's a whole other show. There's a process that I would like to see some type of mix of scholars and perhaps lawyers on the Supreme Court. But the real pursuit has to be the pursuit of an objective meaning in the Constitution, and there are. And by a mix of methodologies from textual integration to plain meaning to original intent to original theory, a person who's willing to work to set aside and find a correct meaning can apply a methodology, but then you have to act on that interpretation to decide the outcome rather than pick the outcome and find the interpretation.
Okay. Well, that, maybe that is a separate show.
That's an entirely separate
show. Okay. No, but it's an interesting thing to think about. Mark, some final thoughts from you. Do you think going forward, are you concerned that, 30 seconds here, that we're more politicized than ever on the courts, or is this a healthy discussion? Do you think it's a sign of health?
No, I think this is a good discussion to have. I think when these type of things come up, it gives people a reason to discuss what's appropriate. And the Supreme Court has obviously evolved over time. There were discussions of the way it's developed, things that were considered appropriate earlier on and maybe not so much now. And without these discussions, that'll never happen. So it's important that this sort of continues as time passes and things like this come up once in a while.
All right, look, I think it's... always more interesting. We've got guests who may have differing views on this, and certainly the American people have been weighing in on Justice Ginsburg's comments from various angles. I want to thank our guests, Mark Foti, criminal defense attorney and chair of the Monroe County Bar Association Criminal Justice Section. Always nice to see you, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
And Jim Bowers, professor of political science and legal studies at St. John Fisher College. Jim, thank you very much as well.
You're welcome.
Our thanks as well to Judge Patricia Marks for joining us earlier this hour. Let's get a short break and more connections next.